Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Morrissey. My name is Bill Stanton, and I represent Shannon Bennett. Mr. Bennett's case reached this court as follows. He was indicted for possessing cocaine with intent to deliver. He filed a motion to quash arrest and suppress evidence. The district court denied that motion without a hearing. Mr. Bennett then pled guilty, reserving the right to appeal that decision, and he was sentenced to 151 months imprisonment.
So I have a factual question for you, Mr. Stanton. I take it from the opening of your brief on page 2 that Mr. Bennett concedes that his nickname is Shine. The beginning of the statement of the case, Shannon Bennett, a.k.a. Shine.
Judge, that's what he was indicted as.
So I don't see any place where he contests that. I mean, the reason that's important to me is because in the telephone calls that were intercepted, you know, there's reference to, you know, Shine's crib and so on.
Sure,
and
Judge,
so
and I think you're... I think you're referencing the June 27, 2007 telephone call, not between Mr. Bennett, but between Mr. Atkins and a person named Watts.
I understand, but they're talking about going to Shine's place. And if Mr. Bennett never takes issue with the fact that he is, in fact, Shine, then that makes a difference, I think. That ties him into this operation.
Well, Judge, if they were referring to taking cocaine to Shine's crib, or if they were saying that Shine liked that cocaine, then I could see how it would tie him into this conspiracy. But the actual conversations were, did you take it up to Shine's crib? Shine liked it.
Yeah, it worked for Shine. It worked for Shine Man. You know, he liked it, et cetera. All the colorful language. You know, that's the way it is. Well, anyway, the reason I asked the question is I could not find any place where he says, I'm not Shine. I have no idea who that is.
Right,
Judge. He seems to concede that he is, in fact, Shine.
And that wasn't a concession, but I think had he been afforded an evidentiary hearing in front of Judge Gottschall, he would have been able to at least deduce evidence of another nickname that he went by.
But he didn't tell her that that was an issue that he wanted to explore. I mean, you've got to let the district judge know what the hearing would be needed for.
Sure, Judge, but I think the two main issues in the probable cause analysis in this case were that purported deal on June 27, 2007, and then the purported deal at Woodfield Mall on the date of arrest, July 20, 2007. Those were the two main prongs of the probable cause analysis that Mr. Bennett asked for an evidentiary hearing on four different occasions, and the district court denied him that, somehow stating that he had never requested that.
Well, what evidence, maybe you can tell us right now, what would the point of a hearing have been? What was he proposing to explore?
Well, Mr. Bennett could have said that, no, I did not engage in a narcotics transaction with Mr. Atkins back on June 27, 2007. That the interpretations you have of a phone call between Mr. Atkins and Mr. Wasp, referring to my nickname or my alleged nickname, that didn't involve a narcotics transaction with me. Secondly, these observations that you make of me at Woodfield Mall on July 20th, 2007, that also did not involve a narcotics transaction with me.
But she can assume, I mean, you know, the facts are the facts. You're talking about inferences from the facts, especially if he never alerts her to the fact that he's, you know, I want to show that there's somebody else who's Shine, or that nobody's ever called me Shine in my life, or, you know, whatever. I can see why she wasn't convinced that any facts needed exploration. It was more inferences from facts.
Well, Judge, I think the inferences from the facts and the facts themselves are so interrelated in this case as far as reports that...
Well, Atkins is a very well-known drug dealer, is he not?
I mean, he's alleged to be. I mean, it's never alleged that Mr. Bennett knows him to be a well-known drug dealer.
Well, it's very unlikely that he doesn't. But I think that's a plausible inference, is it not?
Well, he's alleged to be a multi-kilogram cocaine trafficker. Of those numerous deals that he supposedly enters into, a total of six of them, I believe, are at Woodfield Mall, which leads to the conclusion that most of his deals are not at Woodfield Mall. He's also alleged to be dealing out of a car wash that he owns and making deliveries to people's houses. So for the argument to be that Shannon Bennett met him at his hot spot for dealing drugs, Woodfield Mall, I think that's disingenuous, because only a handful of times was it shown that Mr. Atkins actually used Woodfield Mall as his locus for dealing.
I mean, bearing in mind the standard for probable cause, I have to say it looked to me like, you know, even though apparently Mr. Bennett's a careful driver, they had a lot of evidence pointing to the likelihood that there was a drug transaction. So the stop was, you know, given probable cause doesn't mean, you know, you've already proven it. It just means probable cause.
Absolutely. That probable cause, a probability that criminal activity is afoot.
Right.
You look at their surveillance at Woodfield Mall, numerous FBI agents watching Shannon Bennett for a period of 3 hours while he's there shopping and eating with a female acquaintance and then by himself. And then
he meets up with Atkins, and they do this weird little thing in the car and drive a few feet across the parking lot.
It wasn't a few feet across the parking lot, and it's a weird little thing because the FBI agent said it was, but it was basically Atkins driving him to his car that was in a different section of the parking lot, which...
Well, I know it's a big mall, and I know it's
sure.
a big parking lot, but still in all.
But during that 20-minute meeting, there's nothing that's exchanged, no bag.
Well, nothing visible. It actually looks like whatever was exchanged got tucked in his waistband, right?
That's the allegation.
Right.
But of these numerous FBI agents that are watching this interaction take place, and they have a video of it, and they have people in place to watch what happens between these two men, they see nothing.
Let me ask you a question about the sentence. Why is his upbringing relevant to the sentence?
I think it's in the section 3553, one of the factors, the history and characteristics of the defendant, the fact that he was pushed out on the streets as an 8-year-old to deal drugs for his mom, who was a prostitute, who basically got him into this line of work.
Doesn't that you wanted it, a 24-month sentence. Doesn't this make it more likely that if he had a short sentence, he would go back into the drug business when he got out?
I don't think so. I think that we showed
What's the experience with these people with a bad upbringing? A lot of recidivism, or they go straight when they get a short sentence, or
there's a lot of recidivism, but in this case, Mr. Bennett...
Are there any statistics on this? Any studies?
I'm sure there are.
You didn't present any. If you presented some hard data to a judge, you might do better in asking for leniency. But this isn't done, I take it.
Not in this case. I see my time's up. I'll reserve some for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Ms. Morrissey?
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Megan Morrissey, and I represent the government in this matter. The District Court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress should be affirmed because the totality of the circumstances indicate that officers had sufficient probable cause to stop and search the defendant. As Your Honor questioned defense counsel, the facts leading up to the defendant's stop and search included numerous phone calls over a period of a number of hours between the defendant and Robert Atkins. Robert Atkins was a significant drug trafficker who had previously conducted at least six drug transactions at Woodfield Mall. And again, agents had reason to believe that Atkins had previously supplied the defendant with narcotics. So
Now Bennett is the only person in this indictment who he has his own private count, basically. You've got the conspiracy, and then you tag Bennett along at the end.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It is a little funny to sort of sweep him and him alone into this. We've got all this kind of chatter with Wasp and, you know, these various other people.
Your Honor, when you contrast the government's evidence against Mr. Bennett standing alone with the evidence we had against the remaining defendants, a number of the other defendants in the case were just intercepted far more frequently over the wiretaps, conversing with Mr. Atkins over a period of time. In this case, as Your Honors know, the government's evidence against the defendant was limited to one drug transaction that took place on or about June 27th and one drug transaction that took place on June 20th. And so under those circumstances, the government felt that a conspiracy charge was not appropriate. But again, as I said, Your Honor, you know, it is against, you know, a backdrop of a lot of facts informing agents about not only the background of the defendant, but also of Mr. Atkins, with whom the defendant met, that led the district court to properly conclude that the defendant's actions in this case were consistent with the behavior of drug trafficking and drug dealing. And so for those reasons, we believe that the district court's denial of the motion should be affirmed. We further believe that the district court's denial of defendant's motion without an evidentiary hearing should also be affirmed. As Your Honor pointed out, the defendant has failed at every point along the road to identify any specific facts in dispute. You know, beginning with the defendant's motion in the district court, Exhibit A to that motion was the government's criminal complaint, and Exhibit B was the government's video surveillance. At every point along the way, the defendant has taken the position that he does not dispute the words spoken on the phone calls or the physical observations made during surveillance. The only thing in dispute has been what inferences to be drawn from those facts. And that is just a very different way of saying, do these facts amount to probable cause?
So I take it that the government, in fact, does have him under absolutely continuous surveillance from the time he shows up at Woodfield Mall till the time 75 minutes after he starts driving, he's pulled over.
That is correct, Your Honor. While he was in Woodfield Mall, he was under video surveillance through the mall's security cameras in the parking lot. And after he left the mall, he was then surveilled by a set of Chicago police officers who, as you know, followed him into the city and stopped him about an hour later.
So there couldn't have been any effort to say, I'm not the guy in the videos.
You know, that certainly is an argument that could have been made, Your Honor, but it was not an argument that has been made by this defendant at any point in this case. To your point about whether or not the defendant is, in fact, does go by the nickname Shine, again, that's an argument that could have been made but was not made in this case at any point along the way. So because there has been no disputed issue of fact, the district court properly denied the motion without an evidentiary hearing. And finally, the government believes that the district court's sentence should be affirmed because it was...
I have a question about the sentence. Do you ever present data about, you know, recidivism and this, backgrounds of people? It's just, you know, words.
We do not often present data, Your Honor. I agree that such data may be useful and informative for the court. I do believe, though, that... oftentimes questions about recidivism and about how people with backgrounds like the defendant will act in response to sentences, those decisions are made based on the district court's own experience in sentencing over a number of years and in dealing with recidivist defendants.
What do district judges know about this? Do they get the same criminal back when he recidivates?
No, but they certainly do review each defendant's pre-sentence investigation report, which would indicate the defendant's criminal history.
I have noticed that in cases involving sexual abuse of minors, there are studies that are occasionally referred to in which they look at factors that predict recidivism. You know, has this person, if it's a pornography case, has this person actually had physical contact with children? That's a predictive of recidivism. And other things like that. Obviously, the data exists, and you would think with these drug criminals that... a great deal is known about them, right? There are many of them, and they have different backgrounds, different age, different recidivism rates, and you'd think that that would be systematized. So you might say a person with this upbringing is very unfortunate that he should have had such an upbringing, but a person like this really is never going to find anything he can do except dealing drugs. Which, of course, is the argument for the long sentence. And that obviously troubled Judge Gottschall. I mean, she's, you know, worried about protecting the community from him, but it doesn't seem to be any attempt to base these sentences on data. Not that the statistical predictions are 100% reliable or anywhere near it, but give a little more objectivity, I would think, to the sentencing process.
And, Your Honor, I'm not aware of that type of data existing specifically as it relates to drug defendants. It may exist, but I'm not personally familiar with it. And that may be because the drug crimes are so prevalent and do tend to touch on such a wide variety of backgrounds in the defendants that it's difficult to distill predictive factors.
But you must have data. I mean, of course, we see this all the time, that somebody will come before the federal judge and there were three prior state convictions for drug dealing, and every time the guy gets out of prison, he's back out there on the street. So, I mean, so you have some background, at least at a particular level.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And in fact, that's really very similar to the analysis that was conducted in this case. Judge Gottschall looked at this specific defendant's background and noted that he was, in fact, a recidivist. His criminal history began at age 13 and continued repeatedly throughout his life. And every time he was released from prison, he went back to what he knew, which was drug dealing and gang banging and criminality.
Right.
And
so, she says no sentence so far has persuaded you not to go back into this business.
That's correct, Your Honor. But although, you know, as Your Honors know from the transcript, she was quite sensitive to his arguments in mitigation and to the extreme nature of his upbringing. And so balancing all of those factors, she arrived at a sentence at the low end of the guidelines. And given her thoughtful analysis, I believe he's in his late 20s to early 30s. I don't recall specifically.
I thought
12 years might be too short, right?
That was certainly the position the government took, Your Honor. But again, for all of those reasons, the government's position is that the defendant has failed to rebut the presumption of reasonableness that attaches to a sentence.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Morrissey. Mr. Stanton, anything further?
Ms. Morrissey brought up that there were numerous phone calls between Atkins and Mr. Bennett on the date of arrest, and I'd like to distinguish those phone calls between the phone calls that Atkins had with other individuals who were receiving narcotics from him. You have phone calls where they're talking about a half bird for 11, a whole heezy for 400, the loss is on the dealers. Those are conversations that Mr. Atkins has with other individuals. With Mr. Bennett, they simply set up a time to meet at Woodfield Mall. Those numerous conversations were very short in duration, and they happened between 12 o'clock, 12:17 p.m., and 5:17 p.m., so over a five-hour period. As you mentioned, this is limited to two alleged transactions with Shannon Bennett. There's no other allegations that he's caught on any wiretaps, that they have recordings of him setting up deals with Mr. Atkins. So that's why he wasn't charged in this conspiracy. It is just a rather isolated incident, if you will. As far as the sentence goes, I think it was concerning for Mr. Bennett that the district court stated, I've got to go to the guidelines on this. It was our position that his conviction for when he was 15 years old was inappropriately counted, and the fact that she felt constrained. Why was it our position? Because we felt as a juvenile offender committing a crime at 15, while...
The other argument is the earlier they start, the longer they're going to keep doing it, right?
That's a flip side, Judge, yes.
But that's just talk, right?
That's an argument.
An argument that has no backing, in fact. Just rhetoric, right? You say, oh, well, what you do when you're a kid doesn't count. And the other side says, oh... What you do when you're a kid establishes a pattern and likely to be repeated in your adult life. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Stanton. You were appointed, were you not?
Yes, sir.
So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. And thank Ms. Morrissey as well.